ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
All right, it's now time for this.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Yes, and I imagine to the relief of news editors looking for engaging sound grabs, and quite a few Tasmanians as well, Jackie Lambie has been re-elected for another term in the federal parliament. Now, the Electoral Commission today announced, confirmed Senate results for Tasmania and the Northern Territory, and the six Senate seats were won by two Labor senators, two Liberals, the Greens' Nick McKim and Jackie Lambie, who came in fifth spot. Now, that meant that Lee Hansen, the daughter of the One Nation founder Pauline, was unsuccessful in her attempt to win a Senate seat. Now, I, for one, am very pleased that the straight-talking Jackie Lambie, she's a character, will be back, giving us her assessments of federal politics, which often were right on the money. Here she is just before the May 3rd election, calling it as it was.
Not coming out with your policy and your costings still towards the end. I mean, that's just ridiculous. What were they expecting? You want to govern, but you actually don't want to tell us how you're going to do that. That's just ridiculous. I reckon they've lost a lot of, those people that thought they may have voted for them. I reckon the last week they've lost quite a lot.
Yeah, go get them, Jackie. Elsewhere in the Senate count, in the Territory, well, as expected, Labor and the Coalition won two seats on offer, with Mulindiri McCarthy, Federal Minister for Indigenous Australians, elected to the first spot, and Jacinta Nabajimba Price, the country Liberal senator, of course, came in second. Now, the AEC also declared the Senate results for South Australia yesterday. The remaining states and territories will be coming in following days. Now, it's looking as though Labor could end up with between 28 and 30 seats in the Senate, Greens on 11, and the Coalition with 27. So that's the state of play. With us for Nightlife News Breakdown tonight is Mark Kenny. G'day, mate.
G'day there, Tim.
Jackie Lambie would be relieved. It came in at number five, but her voice does cut through. I just think she's always been a breath of fresh air, really.
I don't disagree. I think she is, as you say, a very straight talker. She's quite a good communicator. She's capable of going from her sort of resting position to flat out angry within the space of a couple of seconds. There's a little bit of Bobcatter about her in that regard.
Yeah.
But she's much more sensible, I think. And what I think is refreshing about her is that she brings a completely different perspective, and she's actually quite hard to define. On some issues, you might say she sits on the right. On other issues, you might say she sits more close to the centre or even on the left. On some issues, she's kind of populist, but she's also principled in some things. And her vote definitely can't just be taken for granted if anyone's looking for it to get legislation through.
Yeah, and a defeat for One Nation's ambitions to have a pair of Hansons in the Senate. Can I just preempt it by saying One Nation's been around a long time now and don't seem to be cutting through very much. I mean, you would have thought, popular wisdom, I guess, that One Nation might get some disaffected Liberal voters on the Conservative side, but it's not really happening, is it?
That's right. And, of course, we had Clive Palmer's armpit of apricots or whatever it was called. which spent trillions of dollars trying to get someone elected and doesn't appear to have got anyone elected. It's a bit of a wild place on the sort of populist right there. And of course, proportional representation works in the Senate and the preference flows can be quite complex and so forth. It is actually quite hard to work out who gets these, fifth and sixth spot in each of the states. And sometimes you can get some different results. I mean, there's another One Nation senator, Malcolm Roberts.
Eluded
me for a moment there. But, they have had, the odd other person get elected, but it is a very much an election-to-election proposition. Mm. And it's getting quite sort of busy there too. I mean, the Liberal Party itself and the Nats have tended to move more to the right, partly to cover off, being sort of stalked on their right flank by these smaller parties. So, it's difficult terrain. And I think it was, I'll just say this, I'm glad to see Jackie get back. And the idea of a brace of Hansons in the Senate was not, I don't think, something too many people were looking forward to.
Yeah. Now, I really love this, I have to tell you. South Australia, Charlotte Walker, have been pre-selected in the usually unwinnable third spot on the South Australian ticket, was elected and becomes Australia's youngest ever senator at 21. In fact, her 25th birthday was on Election Day on May 3. And she says she hopes to represent other young people and their interests.
I think it's really important that young people can look on TV and in the news and see themselves represented by, you know, other young people.
I'll forgive her for saying news, will you?
Well, just this once.
Only once. I'm going to ring her. Charlotte.
Yeah, it's an odd pronunciation. But, yeah, look, it's a really fascinating kind of outcome, this. South Australia's produced a few of these over the years and a few, very young senators, actually. Mm. If you think back to Natasha Stott Despoja, she was, I think, the youngest at the time she went in, and I think Sarah Hanson-Young may have pipped her. Someone will know the details of this. But, either way, they're both in the ballpark of being among the youngest ever. And now we've, of course, got this person who is actually Charlotte Walker, who is actually, as you say, she's basically 20 as she's running for the the seat, and turns 21 on Election Day, and that's quite a prize, I suppose. Although it hasn't really been finalised until now, and I noticed that Don Farrell, considered the sort of Don of the Senate and certainly the Don of the South Australian right of the Labor Party, has described her as one very lucky person. And I suppose that's true. Mm. We do see a bit of a resonance here with Fatima Payman. Of course, we know Payman left, defected from the Labor Party from the WA Senate. But she was also in a spot considered to be very unlikely to get elected. That is the third spot on the Senate ticket, that in that case WA. And it was the popularity of Mark McGowan and, the buoyant nature of Labor in WA that suddenly saw them get all three of their candidates up in that Senate election. We've seen something of the same thing happen here in South Australia. I mean, obviously the government federally has done quite well right around the country, but there's no doubt that Peter Malinauskas is an extraordinarily popular state premier and has that state sort of humming along quite well. And that hasn't done any harm for the candidates, all of whom had Peter Malinauskas on their pamphlets, on their how to vote cards and so forth. So
yeah.
The Labor brand's pretty strong there, and it certainly helped her get up over the line.
Yeah, for the sake of clarity, Wyatt Roy, who was 20 when he became a member of the lower house.
That was quite extraordinary.
And Walker, now at 21, it will be the youngest holder of an upper house seat. And she did say something that I really applaud. She wants to focus on domestic violence prevention and educate young people about politics. I think that second one's very worthwhile.
It is, and it's interesting that, among the various discussions that happen, some of which I've been part of, around ways to renew Australian democracy or to protect it and to make sure that it's still relevant and that it's embraced by young people, because there's some fairly disturbing research that shows a lot of younger people are either indifferent about democracy and in some cases don't believe it's even the best system.
Yeah.
And, of course, we've had very high levels of buy-in for our democracy. It's been institutionally very solid and well trusted, and the electoral commissions are the most trusted single institution in the country. So ways of sort of bolstering that, of buttressing it against all of these other pressures, have been thought about. And among those suggestions that come up is this idea of having a youth senate or a youth contingent in parliament. Mm. These are ideas that just get floated from time to time.
Yeah.
In a way, we get the benefit of that kind of thing with this, sort of unpredictable outcome here where we've got someone so young, and Payman is still there, and she's, of course, still quite young as well, and there's a few others who are not long in the tooth by any stretch.
Yeah, no, it's
so
good
it's
to see.
A good thing.
Yeah, it is. It's good to see. Now, the absolute, it's heartbreaking to watch on television, the devastation of the floods in New South Wales. Now, the Prime Minister was on the scene alongside army personnel and scores of emergency crews today, also announced additional funding to support those affected. So if you're eligible, in nine areas, receive a $1,000 payment, and I think it's $500 for kids. And they've had significant property damage. It was just dreadful. And, you know, it's been tragic as well with the loss of life. So also locals have lost work in 19 flood-affected areas will also now be eligible to apply for a 13-week income support payment. Now, here's the Prime Minister today.
There are still massive challenges, and we need to understand, and certainly the government understands, that this isn't something that will go away in a matter of days or weeks or even months. This will take some time, the recovery.
Yeah, it will, and it just seems to never end. They haven't really recovered from the last flooding. Anyway, the other issue is, of course, and this is a big one, and I'll get Mark's thoughts on this in a tick, insurance. Now, the industry has mobilised resources across flood-hit areas of New South Wales, responding to the widespread damage, well, mid-north coast, Hunter, Greater Sydney, and insurance claims already numbering close to, are you ready, 5,000 insurance claims. One worrying aspect is the flood-affected areas were already recovering, as I say, from floods only a few years ago. It seems to have been ongoing. Well, I think there's been, you know, four floods, some worse than others, in the past 6 or 7 years. And that's a point the Prime Minister made today.
People have spoken about the 2021 floods and how that had a devastating impact, but they thought that would be the peak. Well, this flood has been far worse and the impact has been far more severe.
Yeah, Anthony Albanese, and Canberra Times political analyst and professor at the ANU Australian Studies Institute is Mark Kinney. He's with me tonight. Now, big issue insurance, mate.
It certainly is, Tim. And the problem for a lot of these people, of course, is that they just can't get insurance. And
that's right.
As I heard someone making the point this morning, it's not that, you know, we might just assume from that that insurance becomes uneconomic, you know, that it becomes so expensive that it's really difficult. Well, that's certainly been the case for a number of people. But there are also quite a few people who say it's literally not possible to obtain, that you are, if you have a house in a certain area, might be a floodplain, might be, you know, riverine country near these water systems, that these houses become uninsurable. Literally, the insurance industry is not offering cover for them because the actuarial risk of everyone carrying, you know, having insurance and sort of going under at the same time is just too high for those companies to cover. And so it's not economic for them to do so. So you've got this whole problem. And of course, you know, we've seen, local governments and state governments, you know, building on this land. We need, you know, we have a growing population and we have spreading footprint and so forth. And we know there's a shortage of housing. So housing gets built in these places, but we're now finding that there's a real cost to it, now, particularly with the advent of climate change. You mentioned the frequency of those floods.
Yeah.
You know, these are often told, the people are told, you know, this is a 1 in 100 year flood or a 1 in 500 year flood. Yeah. And then 3 years later, they're having another one.
Another one. I mean, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, you know, I told our listeners last night, and I've mentioned it on the ABC often. I mean, in my near neighbourhood, now I'm not affected by the flooding because I'm on the high side of the road. So we've been okay right through all of this period of flooding over the last few years. But down on the Hawkesbury, you know, only 10 or 12 minutes from me, they're uninsurable for two reasons. Either the insurance company won't do it or the premium's ridiculous, you know, like 30 grand. I mean, and people just can't afford it. So, I mean, it's a massive problem. It really is.
It is such a massive problem. And you know, there's going to have to be money spent on this. There are going to have to be there are programs I know that are operating in some local government areas and some state governments are looking at this or maybe even doing it of you know, raising homes, of putting them on stilts and making them more resilient to floods. That makes sense, of course. It should have been the way they were built the first time around, and to sort of do it as a retrofit, I imagine, is exceedingly expensive. But we have to address this somehow. We can't just pretend it's going to go away. It looks like it's becoming more of an ongoing risk and needs to be addressed.
Yeah, it sure does. Now, this is another big issue, the cost of construction. Speaking of housing, the Federal Government's Productivity Commission and the Committee for Economic Development in Australia, or CEDA, if you like, have been looking at efficiencies in the housing sector. And this is fascinating. CEDA says the tax system needs to change to build up the construction sector and deliver badly needed housing. And they found the nation is building half as many, let me repeat that, half as many homes per construction worker as we were doing in the 1970s, 50 years ago. Here's the chief economist, Cassandra Winzar. She points out how the current system favours more small construction business people and is holding back progress on tackling the housing crisis.
And if we were able to increase the size of firms and a similar structure of the industry to something like manufacturing, that could unlock the equivalent of 150,000 additional construction workers. And that would make a big difference in getting somewhere on our housing targets.
Cassandra Winzar from CEDA. Now, Mark, interesting findings when you look back at the 1970s compared to now. And you comment first, then I'll tell your story.
Yeah, well, I mean, my only comment there is it just feels like it's so counterintuitive. I mean, we're meant to be working smarter and more efficiently. We've got much better technology than we had 50 years ago. You know, the power tools are extraordinary compared to what they were and are all free of long cords and so forth. I mean, you would have thought... you know, free of other inputs, you would have thought that it's a more efficient process now than it has ever been. And yet, as you say, constructing only around half as many homes per construction worker as the 1970s, that is quite a surprise. I suspect, and I don't know this for sure, but I've been surrounded by building sites. We have where I'm living here in Canberra. We've been surrounded by building sites on three sides over the last 2 years. You know, rebuilds really of you know, where there was a house and it's been knocked down and replaced with higher density housing.
Well,
and
yeah.
I was just going to make the point that the quality of these housing is just over the top. You know, like I'm sort of not surprised because. You know, the number of bathrooms that are in each house the quality of the fittings and everything else. I mean, the standards are significantly higher. And, of course, that's not adding to affordability. That's adding to unaffordability.
Yeah. Well, the story I've got for you is my nearest neighbour is a master carpenter. In fact, he's a shipwright. And one of my sons is a qualified carpenter as well. And I'm telling you, they're both saying these targets they've got are simply not achievable. It's not going to happen because most of those sort of tradies would prefer to work on renos and decks than on a major building site. So, I mean, it's just a problem and it's a fanciful idea. Everyone else knows it, but the government keeps coming up with their targets that they won't reach. They won't even get close. You know?
Yeah. Well, I think this is a real challenge, and I wonder what the sort of tax changes they're talking about, because I know that we have, again, going on the example of here. I was looking yesterday and there was, I think, 17 four-wheel drive utes, some of them with trailers, you know, on this building site that I could see just from my, you know, front window, you know, from the first floor of front window. And all of those four-wheel drives, enormous vehicles that they are of course, partly subsidised by tax breaks,
which has
made them, you know, efficient to buy. But, you know, you do wonder. There's a lot of input costs here.
Yeah, you bet. All right, on to another subject, which is Ed Husic spoke out again today on the situation in Gaza. He's been very forthright on the issue. Now he can speak, perhaps to his cost and lost his position as a minister. But he says Australia should be actively considering targeted sanctions against Israel as it continues the offensive in Gaza. Now, been allowed to, the Israelis allowing small amounts of aid to enter Gaza after blocking supplies for nearly 80 days. And the Prime Minister yesterday said it was outrageous that Israel has blocked the aid. Probably his strongest comments to date. But Ed Husic says words are pretty much inadequate.
There's an expectation we move beyond words and that we start to think along the lines of other friends in the international community, which will shape up ways in which we will now progress from talk to action.
Yeah, he also felt that diplomatic protest was an appropriate step too.
I think we should be calling in the Israeli ambassador to stress that Australia, as a member of the international community, expects that humanitarian aid, particularly medical supplies, be delivered.
Yeah, we spoke to Amy Remicus about this last night too, Mark, and perhaps Australia should be making stronger statements about the Gaza situation. As I say, the Prime Minister is probably the strongest he's ever been. How are you seeing all of that?
Well, I think Husic's right, and I think that Amy's right, if I understand what she said last night. I mean, there is a very strong case now. There's an open and shut case that there are atrocities being enacted there that we've seen on our nightly news as, you know, whole families wiped out. We've seen, you know, hospitals bombed and a school that was being used as a shelter was a story tonight. You know, it is a horrendous situation. Of course, we know that there was 10 weeks where aid was getting in, no food, no other materials, no medicines. The situation is an extremely dangerous one. And it is up to the Western world in particular, which talks about universal values, human rights, the rule of law and so forth, to be speaking out clearly on this. Yes, there are a lot of people who say, you know, you shouldn't reward Hamas for what happened on October 7. And I agree, but I think we're a long way down the track. Heading towards 2 years of this war, 50,000 deaths and the threat of mass starvation of aid being used in that way or withheld in that way. And even now with the plan to use American contractors to deliver aid outside of the normal UN and other aid agencies that have been used in the past, which is what the Israelis are insisting on, there is a complaint that this is being used as a tool to control the population, to corral them into certain areas and to push people out of where they are. All of that, I think, is unconscionable. And for all the complexity here and the power of the Israel lobby in Australia, in the US, in Britain and all those places, I think it is time for governments to muscle up, to grow a bit of a spine here and to speak frankly about this, because I tell you what, 10 years from now, you'll be struggling to find anyone who supported this sort of induced famine. But at the moment, there's a lot of people who need to speak up more clearly.
Yeah, and just a last one, Four Corners expose, the failure of the coalition in the election, as I think everybody just accepts, it was just a disaster, under the title Decimated, which is a good title. What did you make of all of that analysis?
Well, I thought it was good. Outstanding piece of work by Patricia Karvelas and some really terrific interviews. I thought it was interesting some of the people who weren't there. I notice Angus Taylor, for example, is an absolutely key player in the whole process. And, some have blamed for, the failure of the key economic policies that were put forward. Some have blamed him. And, of course, he pulled that stunt, really, of attracting Nampajimpa Price across to the Liberals and running, having her as his running mate. At least that was the plan for the leadership. And then in this aftermath, he's not around to sort of give an account of that. There were plenty of others who spoke. I thought George Brandis was extremely interesting, talking about, you may have seen his quote where he says, we were insulting women, we were insulting, young people, we were insulting people from the cities, universities, public servants. There was a sense by the end of the election that we were running out of people to insult. Pretty frank sort of comments from a Liberal. And I think, the truth is, as I said on Insiders on Sunday morning, when parties get thrashed like this, as Labor had in 75 and 77, they had two really bad results in a row, so quite a sort of a similar situation to where the Liberal Party is now. Labor did some reviews and they did some actually quite difficult structural and cultural reform, and of course they came very close in 1980 and were back in 83 with Hawke and that, and we know what happened after that. So parties can make those adjustments, but if they fail to make those adjustments, if they fail to look at the evidence of how they're not connecting with the mainstream of Australia, they can go over the cliff.
Yeah, indeed. Well, that's great, mate. Mark Kenny, Canberra Times political analyst, professor at the ANU, and also hosts the Democracy Sausage podcast. I have a complaint, Mark. No Democracy Sausage at my polling booth. No cakes, no coffee, no nothing. Zip, zero.
It's un-Australian.
Positively. It's un-Australian. Positively. Thanks, mate. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Tim.
Mark Kenny.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.